We're going to call the Audit and Fiscal Review Committee to order, and first order of business, the clerk will call the roll.
Chairman Senator Klein.
Here.
Lee.
Here.
Peppercorn.
Here.
Representatives Pollard.
Aye.
Hanson.
Here.
Hattlestead.
Here.
Kepenick. Clemine.
Here.
Kreit.
Here.
Marigos.
Here.
Martinson. Mock.
Here.
Nathie.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Okay, committee. Just quickly, do I have a motion on the minutes from the last meeting? I have a motion over Mock. Marigos, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. We have a couple of new members. Greetings, Senator Peppercorn. And Representative Hanson over there. We've got a couple of issues we want to get rolling on. Michael and I have been conversing about when to have this meeting. We're squeezing it in now. It's never a good time, but we'll do the best we can to cover these issues that have come forward. And with that, let's all hear about, if there's anything else, we're going to hear about the Auditor's Office report regarding the performance audit on the space utilization study.
Mr. Chairman.
New face here.
Another new face. Members of the Legislative Audit and Fiscal Review Committee, I am Josh Gallion, State Auditor of North Dakota. I'm just here to kind of introduce our technician, somebody who probably doesn't need a lot of background, but Jason Waller, Performance Audit Manager. He's going to present the space utilization study audit. And then afterwards, there's going to be comments, I guess, for the university system. And then Mr. Eric Wallace is going to be here. He's a certified information system security professional, the director of product development for Command and Control Technologies, Comtech Telecommunications Corp. This is the second time he has done the vulnerability studies for the university system. And he is also a very distinguished former member of the United States Air Force, so very good individual to be doing this report. So I will pass it on to Jason Wall at this time, unless there's questions for me.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
All right.
Jason. Committee members, as we go through this, there's a lot of information here, so we'll just dive in anywhere and ask the questions as we go. So go ahead, Jason.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. You should have a copy of the performance audit report in front of you, or it's available electronically as well. We had left some copies on the back, and seeing that I think everybody has a copy, you'll notice this report is very similar to in format in regards to the other performance audit reports that we've provided to this committee. You'll find a highlights sheet on the gray paper, and then the information related to our work is in the body of the report. There are no recommendations included in this report, and as such, we've included management's response to the audit conclusions at the end of the report. I would start covering information, and I think starting at the top of page one of our report, this committee passed a motion for our office to conduct a performance audit report, or a performance audit, excuse me, of the space utilization study completed for the State Board of Higher Education in the 2013-15 biennium. Included in this motion was a requirement for us to review four specific areas. Our audit conclusion, based on our review of information and in discussions with representatives of the university system, was that a space utilization study was not completed during the 2013-15 biennium. You'll note in the middle of page one there that while a consultant attempted to complete a classroom and teaching laboratory utilization study, the report the consultant issued in March 2015 was not complete, lacked necessary information, and included inconsistent information. Just to make sure, when we talk or when I reference to space utilization, we do include a definition on page one of the report. Ultimately, we narrowed down and we defined space utilization with the use of a formula, which is comprised of a schedule component times a density or occupancy component. I'll briefly discuss information on the events occurring related to the attempts made by the university system to complete a space utilization study. Our report does include an outline of events that in a chronological order in case you're interested in regards to the information that we reviewed and received from the university system, and that's included in Appendix A. The attempt to complete a space utilization study appeared to begin in July of 2012 when the newly hired chancellor requested the State Board of Higher Education amend the budget request to include $1 million to develop a system-wide campus master plan, including a space utilization study. The $1 million was included in the governor's executive budget recommendation and ultimately passed by the 2013 legislature. In June 2013, the chancellor was put on administrative leave and the board appointed a new interim chancellor. We concluded the change in that leadership role led to confusion related to the intended scope of the space utilization study and the master plan project. Starting in December of 2013, a selection committee comprised of various university system representatives selected a vendor to perform a master plan and space utilization study. The original contract was for $975,000, included 8 components. We do provide additional information about the contract selection process in Appendix B of the report if you are interested.
We have a question, Representative Maragos.
Going back to
Andrew, you want to push the button there on the.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you. Going back to your comment on the confusion of the scope of the audit, was the confusion in an expansion form or a contraction form, or can you elaborate on the confusion a little bit?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, from our discussions and including information provided to various legislative committees during the interim, I think the confusion was exactly what was the master plan and space utilization study to entail. What was it supposed to review? What was supposed to be included? What should be excluded? $1 million being provided, I think early on the university system, as they started to make some phone calls, began to realize that $1 million maybe wasn't enough money to complete a full space utilization study and master plan. When the former chancellor went on administrative leave, I think the thoughts and the process that was going to be used went along with that individual at that time. The interim chancellor would have met with various representatives remaining within the university system in an attempt to identify what the scope of that project should be. Ultimately, the main scope and the request for the $1 million wasn't documented that we were able to see. And for the most part, the former chancellor was kind of the driving force behind the $1 million request, and therefore when he left, the intent or scope for that $1 million went with him.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, at the bottom of page 2 and continuing on to pages 3 and 4 is information related to the first report that the consultant issued. This report is dated June of 2014. The report included master planning information as well as information on demographics, information technology infrastructure, as well as other areas. The consultant did conclude in the June 2014 report that master plans do not contain any space utilization or space needs elements, which is normally a part of master planning. Other areas identified in the report, including that only three of the 11 campuses were able to produce room inventories at that time. The consultant did not draw any reliable conclusions regarding classroom usage, and the data at the time was deemed unreliable and was not included in any analysis. Beginning on page 4, the second set of information the consultant would have provided to higher education related to 2 memos. The memos are very similar in regards to the information that is being provided, which related to assignable square footage based on headcount. We did note in the second memo that was issued, the consultant used total headcount, and the overall total assignable square footage per headcount was thus significantly reduced compared to the first memo issued. Information related to the consultant's final report begins near the bottom of page 5. In February of 2015, a contract amendment was entered into for $143,000. The additional services requested in the amendment included analyzing classroom and teaching laboratory utilization, determining utilization targets, and reviewing capital project proposals. At that point in time, the $1 million appropriation amount from the 2013 legislature for the study was for the most part used up. So this contract amendment was paid, over 90% of the contract amendment was paid by the 11 campuses. The report was issued in March 2015, and we identified concerns with this report related to incomplete and inconsistent information. The consultant did state a lack of classroom and teaching laboratory seat count information provided an incomplete utilization picture. Since the consultant's report does not include such information, the density component of the formula on space utilization is lacking. Therefore, when even with the contract amendment with the consultant, our conclusion was at that point in time that a space utilization study had not been completed.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kepnick,
Mr. Chairman, so in other words, for $1 million, we got an incompleted report.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the $1 million, the university system would have received more of a master planning deferred maintenance report in the first issuance of information. Then you would have received some information in a memo format. Ultimately, the biggest chunk of that money would not have gone for space utilization or a space utilization study. Mainly, it appears to us, it's a data-related issue. When you had the consultant come in originally, you had rooms at 8 of the campuses that, for the most part, somebody had to go out and actually measure rooms, or they had to take a significant effort to identify what their room space actually was. Once they were able to identify that moving forward, when you got into the 2015 session, there appeared to be some discussion about where is our space utilization study. That contract amendment in February 2015 then is the kind of final push or attempt to try to get to a space utilization study. As the interim, the campuses were working on trying to get data. They were able to get more of the classroom data cleaned up and more consistent. However, you weren't ever able to get certain other information in, and therefore you couldn't complete a space utilization study at the time.
So did you say we didn't get anything for our money? Is that what you just said?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, higher education may be a better one to answer that. We can certainly point to a number of things included in the the master plan and deferred maintenance. I'm going to touch on briefly that even with that first report, we have some concerns with some of the information that's included in that as well.
And Jason, did we have the interim committee, did you say, worked on this also, and we have a report from them?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it would have been in that interim higher education committee, where higher education would have came and probably provided some updates, the interim chancellor. And through the review of those minutes, you can see where some of that confusion was already being addressed.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kepnick, and then we'll go to Senator Lee.
I just wanted to, the indication, you know, and that's probably one of the problems was that there was some flux of management or leadership going on. But as far as individual universities, was there issues going on that way too? Were some better than others about what they had, or were they all pretty much, was it all pretty much as the same way?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, at the time of the original review, there would have been campuses that would have been further ahead in being able to provide data to the consultant compared to others.
Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knudsen just got the copies of this for me because I remembered that when we had our final committee reports, Representative Sanford had, as usual, given a really interesting report from the Higher Education Committee. And if you look on page 5 of that handout that just came around, there are a couple of extras here if anybody doesn't have one. It certainly isn't as complete as a whole master plan would be, but you do see that there is on page 5 utilization rates for classrooms and laboratories in the university system as well as maintenance costs. So I thought it might be interesting for us to see that as well as a part of this discussion.
Okay, Jason, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On pages 6 through 9 of the report, you'll find the information that we provide related to the requested information that was part of the motion for this performance audit. There are two other areas that I would bring to the committee's attention. The first is on page 9 in relation to a deferred maintenance pool. We did identify the university system received $10 million for a deferred maintenance funding pool for the 2013-15 biennium. Session law provided that the State Board of Higher Education, or provided the authority to the State Board of Higher Education to distribute up to $5 million prior to the completion of the master plan and space utilization study. When the board approved the second $5 million distribution in 2014, no space utilization study had been completed. Thus, we concluded that second distribution was in noncompliance with legislative intent. On page 10, as I had mentioned before, we did identify certain concerns with the deferred maintenance estimates included in the June 2014 report. Excuse me. We did note that the estimates that the consultant came up with in that report were based on a sample of buildings that each campus had selected. Following that report, UND did hire a different consultant to conduct a full condition assessment, spending approximately $375,000. The consultant's deferred maintenance amount was at least double the amount reported in the June 2014 report for comparable building types. Mr. Chairman, the last part of the report that I would cover is in relation to Appendix D, which is the last page of the report. This is the university system's response to the report. They did agree that a space utilization study was not completed. They acknowledged the $5 million of the deferred maintenance funding pool was distributed without a study being done, and that they are going to continue to strengthen existing policies and procedures related to space utilization at all university system institutions. Mr. Chairman, this would conclude my presentation of the report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Any other questions for Jason? Well, Jason, maybe you're off the hook now.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, we have one over here.
Well, it isn't a question. It's more of a statement. I think we're going to find out and just previewing, you know, going into this next session, I think this is more important than I think we're going to realize, because I think deferred maintenance is going to become an issue. It always is, but it becomes more of a tail when budgets get tighter. And the space utilization, you know, see, and that's the thing is there's problems you can identify, and they're brought up, and that's what's frustrating. And I guess higher ed, I always get frustrated when we get into these, is that there's stuff that you could probably use today that you're not going to have, you know, to look at. You know, there's a report here, you know, that's pretty much an overview, pretty broad summary. But it does get a little frustrating when there's stuff you can identify. We're going on, 4 years ago, that are issues, and we don't have anything to show for it outside of some half.
And maybe
half
we'll hear from somebody who's going to tell us that we got something for what maybe somebody got a cap on there. So, Representative Clemene.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Jason, I'm not sure if I'm clear on this, but it seemed like a space utilization study still hasn't actually been done. Is that right, or am I missing something here?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, higher education has been working on a space utilization study to be able to get to those numbers. We did see certain information that higher education was able to identify, excuse me, in regards to space utilization study. What I would say is our review of that information was very brief. At the time, due to the fact we were trying to accomplish the motion from the committee, which related to the study in 1315. I know that they were able for 11 or 10 of the 11 campuses, I believe, to generate certain information in regards to space utilization numbers. You know, we had discussed about trying to review that information as well, and space utilization study becomes hard from an audit standpoint because it's a specific point in time. So what a room was at the time their numbers were developed may not be the same at the time we go in there to review. And unless there's some CAD drawings available, you know, we're going to have a hard time finding the right audit evidence to be able to determine was that room properly classified. And that's a big point in regards to this type of study, is it is a point in time. That may change the next semester, the next year, or it could stay relatively constant depending on changes at that university. I would say in regards to comprehensiveness of a study, you know, the numbers that we see really are related to teaching, well, classrooms and teaching labs. Other studies may include other labs. We know we had some concerns about special labs. They were classified in regards to some of the work done by the consultant. We weren't able to determine, well, should they really be included or excluded? We can tell you that when you have 11 different institutions, the consistency issue always is a risk in regards to, did everybody include everything that they should have, and did everybody include things in a consistent manner? We had said in the last report for that that the consultant issued in 2015, there were some inconsistency issues in regards to what was included and what wasn't included.
Representative Clumine.
So the answer is no. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, they're going to have some numbers from the auditor's office standpoint. What we would say is we haven't audited those numbers, and unless there was a significant change from the time during this current biennium, those numbers, for the most part, would be generated at the campus level.
So the answer is no.
Representative Nafee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jason, it seems to me that at worst we got nothing out of this study, which I think it is, or at best it was inconsistent with the information and everything else. And you say it's a snapshot in time, which I agree, the 1315 biennium. And that was a time when our schools were actually growing in enrollment and on the way up. And now, fast forward to 2017, we're flat or even going down. So it seems to me that this report, the information, quite frankly, would be outdated and really wouldn't be all that useful. I'm just curious what your opinion is on this.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, from an audit standpoint, you know, a lot of times auditors like to look at trends. And if you had a consistent report year after year after year, you may be able to analyze trends and identify maybe where some changes could be made. So would that be outdated given the certain points and times? It certainly could be. I know we identified other states that this is part of their normal, I think they're up to over their 40th report on space utilization study. So there are some benefits to that. The big thing is it's going to take time and it's going to cost money. If you look at what involvement needs to be done, there is going to be a need for, somebody needs to come up with the money to be able to generate useful information. But I would say that if you look from year to year, you could see some fluctuations, but there certainly could be some specific reasons for that which would justify big fluctuations.
So Jason, am I hearing then that the $1 million was certainly not enough money, and the time that would take probably wasn't enough? Because it seems like even with 11 institutions and a lot of stuff to look at, that's a lot of work.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the scope of what that $1 million went for more than likely certainly wasn't enough money or time allocated for that specific component of space utilization. A lot of it due to the fact of unreliable data and no data at some campuses.
Representative Maragos?
Well, thank you. Mr. Chairman. Are you familiar with the last page of the higher ed summary findings?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't believe I am.
Well, I don't know why I want to ask this question, but I'm going to anyway. Was the consultant they hired in-state or out-of-state? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the consultant would have been out-of-state.
Thank you.
Representative Clemene.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if the source of the problem here is that the initial contract or the initial contract failed to accurately delineate the scope of services that were being requested.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, in our review of the contract does spell out the 8 components. I think to a certain extent, keep in mind space utilization was one of those 8 components, and it was a portion of that component. So if you look at scoping, could I say out of that $975,000, excuse me, was in the 8 components, was there a significant portion of that money allocated for space utilization study? No. There wasn't. There is a breakdown, if you would like, back in Appendix B, I believe, of where that $975,000 by the contract would have gone to.
Okay, committee, we're going to have, we have another question. I think I'm going to go to the university system. I'm going to find out what they were thinking. But we'll, Representative Marigos, I'll have you ask the last question here. I think we'll have them, and then we'll don't get too far, because I think we'll have a little exchange here so that we can understand what they were thinking and what. Okay, Representative Marigos.
Jason. Could it have been a cop-out by the contractor stating that some of the institutions were not forthcoming and use that as an excuse for not getting the job done?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, by the contract, the university system was to provide the data to the consultant. Since the data wasn't able to be provided, the potential noncompliance in relation to the contract would have been a result of the university system not to be able to fulfill their contract obligation. And therefore, if they were going to do a space utilization study, it would have taken a lot more time and effort and money than what they were allocated in that first contract.
And Jason, did you get to visit with that contractor?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we did not visit with that contractor.
So your conversations were just with the university system and what they told you, that the information that the contractor gave them?
Mr. Chairman, through the audit work, what we were told we would have corroborated with emails.
Okay.
We received a large dump of emails from higher education, as well as committee minutes and then drafts, and then what the consultant said in the various reports.
Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just follow up on Representative Marigos. So am I hearing you right? So higher ed was not forthcoming with the information that the contractor needed during that time?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I apologize for the confusion. They provided what they could. What they could provide wasn't enough. They did not have the data to be able to provide to the consultant to be able to do a space utilization study.
Go ahead, Representative Merrill.
That begs one more question. Would the NDUS have understood that they didn't have the data?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I believe that's probably a better question for higher education than for me.
Okay, then we'll move on to someone from higher ed. Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Rick Tonder. I'm the director of facility planning, and I'll read into the record the management response there so I can answer questions, you know, based on the management response and others, of course. But the university system agrees that a space utilization study was not completed during the 13-15 biennium, as Jason points out. The proposals received from various consultants indicated that the available funding would not allow for a system-wide master plan and space utilization study. And that was during interview with the consultants, as we asked them, how far could we get with $1 million? Due to budget limitations, the project scope was limited to a master plan, including deferred maintenance and those other components that is in the exhibit or the attachment that Jason pointed to, classroom laboratory utilization analysis. During the review, the consultant noted that the space utilization data provided by the university system, that is the data that we would collect from our institutions, was of questionable quality, appeared inconsistent between institutions, or did not exist at the time of the review, and that is correct. The university system considers the consultant's preparation of the master plan and analysis of space utilization data to be accurate within the limitations of the data quality or the data that we provided them at that time. We acknowledge that the $5 million of the deferred maintenance funding pool was distributed upon completion of the master plan and deferred maintenance project, but it did not include a completed space utilization study due to the lack of funding and lack of necessary data. Funds were utilized for valid, necessary deferred maintenance projects at all campuses, but $5 million disbursement. During the 2015-17 biennium, the NDUS Director of Facilities Planning, myself, continued the master planning and space utilization review process. The State Board of Higher Education at the April 28, 2016 meeting approved institutional master plans, with the exception of the program and an enrollment-driven needs section that would be based on program or strategic needs, which was postponed and remains postponed at this time. The SBHE also approved three recommendations intended to improve classroom and laboratory utilization and reduce deferred maintenance. The recommendations are, 1, require central scheduling of a minimum of 95% of classrooms and class labs at each institution to improve classroom and class lab utilization. Prioritize deferred maintenance projects that improve classroom and class labs which are currently underutilized due to existing conditions. And then remove facilities in lieu of repair where the estimated deferred maintenance cost is greater than 65% of the replacement value unless there is significant historical or other value present in the building. The university system will continue to strengthen existing policies and procedures related to space utilization at all NDUS institutions. And that concludes the response that was in our in the audit report, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
So Rick, what you're saying on the utilization side, there just wasn't enough money, and so you took what you were trying to get the most bang for the $1 million bucks, and just set that aside to a degree. Is that what I'm kind of hearing you say?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. But in addition to that, the campuses had the equation that Jason put up on the screen as to how we determine utilization density and then how often it's used kind of equals utilization. In other words, how often this room is used and how many people are in here is critical. If it's used every day, that's high, but if there's only one person in here, it doesn't do you much good. If it's used every day and it's full of people, that's high utilization. So those are the two components, and I developed that. I said, okay, here's, and it's copying other institutions, and it says, okay, here's how you determine utilization. Okay, UND, NDSU, another institution, Valley City had some data, as to the inventory of rooms, and we qualify that by saying, what kind of room is it? Some institutions would call this room a classroom, some would call it a lobby, some would call it, but we didn't have a standardized approach to saying, how do we classify these rooms? And so we had to start undertaking a cleaning process. That's a classroom, that's a lab, throughout the system. Some of the institutions didn't have how many seats were in each of those classrooms, because that's part of the occupancy. If I say this room is fully occupied at 20 seats, and there's 40 seats in here, that's still not fully occupied. So we need to have how much occupancy will that room hold? And that's a huge amount of data then, with all that square feet to come up with those numbers. Some of the institutions didn't have room numbers in their facilities. They scheduled rooms based on where it was located in the building, but had little more information than that. So the standard data that the consultant would need to point the button and push the button and say, here's your utilization, was either non-existent and we had to create it, or the information that we did have wasn't of the best quality and we had to clean it. So going through this process, the time consumption for facility people that were already pretty busy taking care of maintenance needs was overwhelming in some cases, and we simply couldn't get it done during the biennium. I think the dollars, if you look at the deferred maintenance study that UND did, close to $400,000. That's about a little less than one-third of our total space. If we would have asked to do just a deferred maintenance study, just a deferred maintenance study, about $1.2 to $1.4 million and nothing else. One consultant said to inventory our space, just come up with room data in terms of numbers and say how big they are, there's your $1 million. No utilization, just an inventory. So we picked this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece, a little of this, a little of that, as much as we could so that we could bring back some useful information that said, like of 1, 2, 3 here, we have too much space. We do. Our classrooms aren't utilized very well. We need to improve. And we need to centrally schedule all of our rooms in order for us to better utilize them. And we weren't doing that either. And so those are the things that we could call with certainty. But the data below this, how our office spaces are used, how our auxiliaries are used, it's millions away.
Senator Pepcorn's got a question.
Thank you, Chairman Klein. And I have a question for Senator Lee. And we all have this report from Mark Sanford from November of 2016. Is that correct, Senator Lee, basically? So how close are these? The last page, page 5, we've got university system institution space utilization rates. There, it's the term we're using. How close are these percentages to the formula that is at the very beginning of this report? I mean, how, can we compare them? Are they apples to apples, or are they completely different set of figures? Have you seen it? Can you make a judgment on this?
I have it here. Mr. Chair, yeah, members thanks. Of the committee, Senator Pepcorn, am I saying that right? Thank you. When we look at classroom utilization, we look at the formula interpreted for what is 100% utilization and what percentage of that do they reach. That is based on the data that we collected from all the institutions that I collected to finish up what the consultant started, based on the cleaning of data and the subsequent crunching of numbers. How accurate is it? It still lacks, as Jason would point out, control. I haven't gone to the campuses and been able to say, yep, this is what you put that in there, right? You put that in there, right? So where's my confidence level? Probably around 80%, that I could say between 80 and 90%, these numbers are fairly accurate. In other words, they give us a picture. Virtually all the numbers are below what I would expect is good. The best thing we could have is 100% top to bottom. We're below that in general, except for a few instances.
Senator Lee?
Excuse me, I'd rather focus on your report, but I do want to ask this one question about the one from Representative Sanford, because I remember visiting with him briefly about this after the report was given. And my question is about the laboratory utilization rate. Let's talk about the North Dakota State College of Science, which obviously has lots of labs because those are, I mean, that's a lot bigger than my desk in a room. So do you use a different to use a different determination of lab, or are you saying workstations are 37% occupied rather than square feet are 37% occupied?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Lee, as to it's the workstation occupancy rate, but it's determined by the institution to say how many workstations are in a particular lab, not based on lab size. The reason, of course, for the difference is that State School of Science, their laboratories have tractors. At Valley City, the laboratory might have a guinea pig. So the laboratory size is huge, and so their space is huge. So when we try to think of occupancy for a vocational college and density, it's a different mix. So we have three layers of mix. We have research institutions, we have 4 years, we have 2 years. All of them have a little bit different need in the mix alignment. So it's difficult to compare them simply apples and apples, but that represents the workstation and the occupancy of the workstation.
Representative Pollard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if this is for Rick or for Jason, but when the $1 million was appropriated, did anybody say this is not enough money or this is going to give us insufficient data so that we're sitting here and saying we just wasted $1 million? I don't know. I'm just and I shouldn't say wasted because there is some information here. But did anybody ask if $1 million was not enough or if everybody asked, was it just a plug figure? I'm just trying to get where did we start from in the first place?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Pollard, I wasn't there at the time, but I overhear conversations and I said, boy, that's not going to go very far. And that was 6 months before my hire. And so when we got to that point and said, the $1 million, the consultant said that's not enough. But at the same time knowing, can we take some lemons and make some lemonade? And so looking at, is $1 million better than nothing? Can we get some data that's usable and guiding you and guiding us going forward? And that was my objective. Yeah, we can't do a detailed deferred maintenance study, but I can get a slice of it. I can get a picture and tell us something about where we're at. And we did. We've got a lot. UND suggests we've got twice as much. But as I explained to Dr. Sanford's committee, don't be scared by those numbers. Sometimes it's a bit of a red herring. That deferred maintenance number is for lots of stuff that doesn't necessarily need to be replaced. So therefore, standard practice would be that you want to have 40% of that on the books regardless because you want to tackle it when it comes forward. So let's keep that in the context it is. Yeah, we've got a lot. Let's not worry about what that number is in total. It's too much to even consider. But let's make sure we hammer away at that deferred maintenance with every buck we do get. And that's what we've been doing.
So, Rick, you felt that $1 million, I mean, we're suggesting that it may have not gone very far and didn't do much, but you're suggesting you got some value from that $1 million, that value that you and a system can work with.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. It was a great starting point. Imagine how badly it would have been if it was just me trying to do it. The $1 million went a long way, and it gave us a lot of good info.
Okay. Senator Pepcorn.
Chairman Klein and Rick. And again, set aside the cost of the study. It's history. It's been spent. You got the information that you got. I believe you said that you are 80% confident in some data that you were able to assemble from this study. And I'm thinking, now, is that in not deferred maintenance, but related to Mr. Sanford's study, is that on utilization of classroom and perhaps laboratory? I don't know if you did that. So, I mean, an 80% confidence in this, the information you got from this study, whether or not you're pleased with it, seems pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
That's something. So my question is that the same? You know, classroom utilization figures, your 80% confidence in those sorts of figures? Or I mean, I don't see anything about that in this study. Am I missing it, or is that not in here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Pepcorn, this is the information. I provided this information to Dr. Sanford's committee. And so that's the 80% confidence.
Okay. Well, then there's something there then.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
But once again, I don't think auditors work in somethings. They're digging down to see what the actual numbers are, and as confident as you feel that 80% is pretty good, Jason wants to see it in black and white that it is
very
right
clear.
There, and that's what auditors do. So, Representative Marigold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious. And maybe this is hypothetical, but had the $1 million not been spent, would the $5 million deferment been distributed anyway?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Marigold, it was the goal to complete the study as quickly as we possibly could, so that we could say that it was completed in order for us to say we have to get the deferred maintenance money distributed and spent. We had to get the roofing done. And so we wouldn't have moved forward if the contract hadn't been completed for the value that it had been set for.
Okay. Representative Kepenick.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, it does make kind of like your report on this one that was given to the interim higher education committee. You know, because we do base, I see NDSU's got 176% utilization. Did they get a new lab last year? You know, see, that's the problem, you know, with some of this stuff, because it, you know, it needs to happen. I don't disagree, you know, and if this is the information, you know, I mean, I'm glad, you know, okay, we got something for it and stuff on it. The other question I got then is kind of the response on number three there on the management response. So is 65% the threshold that you, or is that just for this report of deferred, whether you do deferred maintenance or it's beyond deferred maintenance, you know, because we're hundreds of millions of dollars in deferred maintenance. I mean, it's something that I, you know, during the sessions it gets brought up, and it is concerning, because that's like an insurance tail. It's like anything. I mean, it's a tail that's unfunded in a lot of ways. I mean, and that's what concerns a person, because it, you know, I don't want a new roof on a building that the utilization is going to be obsolete in 5 years, or it's going to be tore down in 5 years, you know, and that's what gets concerning is, you know, is the, that, you know, that, and I guess walk me through the thought process on like, on the number three statement there on that, of what, how that works.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kempnick. You'll excuse me. The item number three refers to a return on investment in terms of that deferred maintenance. And when your deferred maintenance gets to be 65% of the replacement value, you're getting to a point whereby you're really not spending your money wisely anymore, because that building can't really respond to the investment anymore. There's so much deferred maintenance in it that where do you start? If you do it systematically, let's say, and take a piece of the roof, but then the heating system fails, well, then you have a roof going cold and plaster going cold, and you probably failed the building because of it froze up. And so setting it up at a point isn't necessarily to say, if your building has 65% of its replacement value in deferred maintenance, no mas. It means that has to be the point where we say, unless there's some mitigating circumstance, you need to take this building offline, remove it, because we don't want to spend any more money on it unless you can justify why to do it. The 65% to 75% is kind of a national range for a building. I think the Capitol building would be excluded because of its historical significance, but if for whatever reason the deferred maintenance of this building was 75%, your elevators wouldn't work, your roof would leak, most of your windows would be out, your finishes would be gone, and you'd have to ask yourself, should we just take it down versus try to fix it up? And so that's where that statement comes from. If the deferred maintenance is at such a level in your building that it's really not worth putting any more into it, let's take it offline. Let's get rid of it.
Chairman, and the question, Rick, becomes, what happened to the deferred maintenance in the years, you know, see, and I guess that's what gets frustrating, you know, that, you know, I mean, at some point you do hit, you know, but if it is structurally sound yet, where, at what point does the deferred maintenance get, or the decision get made, you know, to not maintenance the building, you know, to get it to that 65%? You know, I'm just using that as an example, because there's got to be a conscious decision made someplace that we're going to run this as long as we can and then try something else. And that's, you know, and looking at it from just the 1,000-foot view, you know, when we're up here, that's what kind of gets to looking like a lot of the campuses, there's an intentional of not maintenance, you know, on the deferred maintenance. I mean, there's maintenance, but not doing something, you know, taking the gamble that we want a new building at some point. And that's, you know, I might be a little facetious doing that, saying that, but it's kind of what it looks like and stuff on it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can understand how you could arrive at that. And I, you know, from my position, I know all the facility people throughout the system, and I know how hard they work and how conscientious they are and try to keep the buildings up. But it really becomes a question of just having enough money to maintain what they have. And right now they've got too much to maintain. And so that means the first step has to be right-sizing. And that's the process we're going through. Along the way, we also have to take and develop routine maintenance procedures that allow us to take and let's prioritize the envelope, make sure the building stays water and weather tight. And then from there, we can grow inward. So they are doing those things. And in the current economic times, it's tough. So we've got too much space. We've got to figure out how to knock some of it out. We've got to prioritize our maintenance to make sure our buildings stay warm and our places that can be used for teaching and learning and research. And at the same time, plan for the future. And sometimes what the planning might be is, let's, you know, it'd really be practical to build a new building and take the old ones down because it's more cost effective and it does the job better.
All right, Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, having been in Dunbar Hall lately, I think that that's way beyond the 65%. It's time to throw it away, but we don't get to do that today. I did just want to clarify something, and this is more important than this, but we were just alluding to the 176% on NDSU's lab rates. Am I correct in saying, since 100% laboratory utilization rate is 20 hours a week at 75% capacity, that just tells me that they're being used way more than 20 hours a week at 75% capacity. It means that the labs are actually crowded. That's what 176% tells me. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Lee, you are absolutely correct.
Because I think that's important to note that it isn't because it's been, I think it's important we not misinterpret it. That would be the better way to put it.
Designing the new medical school, if I could elaborate on the process, it was that we would set a utilization rate for the classrooms that allow for different lab setups between labs. And so if you wanted to pack it as tight as you could probably use a specialized lab twice a day for 3 hours each session. That's 6 hours. Now you might think, well, 100% should be 8 hours. We can't pack it that tight. We can't get it that close together. So we set 100% utilization as the rate that best suits the use of the classrooms and use of the labs, where you can get a student from across campus to this building without in that 5 minutes in between and trying to schedule it that way. So 100% utilization would mean is that we're trying to push it in there as fast as we can. If they have 175% on a lab, it means that they're pushing it in too tight, too many people in the lab, or they're using the lab for over that time period. And that's a concern because that can lead to life safety issues in the laboratory. Mike Ellingson at NDSU is trying to keep that from happening, and that's the Dunbar Hall issue.
So is the fire department.
And the fire department is concerned as well. But we keep tackling those issues, and when that number comes up, it's not to say, hold it, we've got to look at that and determine how we're going to fix it. So these are really administrative tools. They're not guaranteed rock solid numbers. They're to raise a question. If your utilization is high, what's going on? Let's fix it. If your utilization is low, what's going on? Let's fix it. And the master plan that the institutions now look at space utilization, deferred maintenance, and all those other components in order to formalize a strategy. and the strategy might take down Dunbar Hall or replace it. That's after you look at all that info. I'm blathering. I'm all sorry.
Right. Okay, one more question, then we're going to have to move along. So, Resident Clemente.
Mr. Chairman, Rick, I'm sorry I didn't get your last name.
Ponder. If you're Danish, it's Tunna.
Oh, really? Anyway, according to this management response, the State Board of Higher Education met April 28, 2016, and came up with these recommendations. And now here we are about 10-plus months later, and could you tell us what's happened to these recommendations since April 28, 2016? Is anything going on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are virtually limiting any request for new construction to come in to be deferred maintenance or life safety. The new buildings request, as you know, there has been a couple that come forward, but there have been many more that were kept at the board level, were not approved. They wanted this building or that building, wanted additional space. No. So we've made headway. We still are working on the centralized scheduling. That'll help us with the utilization. Plus, the prioritization and remove of facilities. At UND is an example. They're scheduling roughly 11 buildings to go away. And so that's just one example.
Okay. Rick, you've been how long have you been with the university system?
3 years now.
3 years, and you must have had another job ahead of this. I know you look a little older than maybe.
Yep,
25.
Hard, put away wet all too often, but I worked as this in this position at the University of North Dakota.
Okay, so you've been within the system. You, all right.
30-odd years.
All right. All right, we're going to move along so that we can kind of keep on a time frame here. And with that, we're going to listen to the audit report on technology.
Is there anything I need to do,
it was
Mr.
Close.
Chairman, to get the projector?
Need a projector? Michael's working on it.
Okay.
There shouldn't be anything plugged down.
It's a virtual screen.
I'm not using
it. To be able to.
Yeah. I'd have to use it.
No,
that's for audio.
I think it came on. It sounds like something's running. Yeah. It might be Wi-Fi then. You might have turned the lights down. Well, there we go.
Oh,
turn the lights down.
Coming up. No. Just the camera needed to get warmed up.
Sorry, Alice.
Well, I guess first
thing
look at it
this way, too.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
There
we go.
Yeah, that works.
All right, good afternoon.
All right, Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the committee, thank you for allowing me some time to brief you during this session. My name is Eric Wallace. As mentioned earlier, I manage the team at ComTech that perform the assessments that are within the report that you all hopefully have. Three assessments were completed in 2016, a vulnerability assessment, a phishing assessment, and a policy and procedure assessment. On behalf of the North Dakota State Auditor and the university system from September 12th to October the 20th, 2016, our team carried out the external and internal network assessments on the North Dakota University system and the campuses associated with that. Just a high level, I wanted to give you an idea of the methodology that we go through when we conduct a vulnerability assessment. We look at open source, determine whether or not we can discover the network both externally and internally to the system. So we perform scanning to do that. and host discovery. If we can find a set of hosts, we look for ports that are open on those hosts. Once we see that there are ports that are open, we use the information that the port's passing in and out of the port to do application identification and OS identification. And that lets us know, is it a XP machine, or is it a Linux box, or is it a web server, or things like that. And then based on that data and the classification that we get around it, we can start looking up vulnerabilities that we know that exist associated with that machine. And that allows us to put together a vulnerability assessment report associated with the machines inside the network. The external assessment findings that we were able to produce show that the IT security of the system has improved over the past year, with the number of overall external vulnerabilities decreasing by more than 19% versus 2015. We initially had performed, this is actually the third year that we've performed the set of vulnerability assessments. We started in 2014, we did 2015, and we did 2016. If you look at the overall results of the external vulnerability assessment, they look pretty good. The number of vulnerabilities are decreasing year over year, from 14 to 15 and 15 to 16. The number of criticals have been driven down and are staying low. Highs are decreasing, mediums are on their way down, and I would expect criticals and highs are the things that the university system would focus on. One of the things that we did look at a little bit this year and we included in the report were the amount of actual vulnerabilities that were resolved and how many were new associated with our findings. And we found that about 50% of critical vulnerabilities were being resolved externally, about 68% of those were new. I'd like to see that number, the 50% associated with what's being resolved year over year, to be driven up. So if the university system could get that more to like 100%, that would be a better number. Because we're coming back a year later, in the course of a year, we would expect all of those to be resolved. Highs, if they wanted to defer them, they could defer them depending on how they wanted to roll that out, but criticals should be resolved if possible. And if it's not possible, they should have some mitigation plan associated with whatever they were doing. The internal vulnerability findings, you find a similar trend. In 2015, they actually went up a little bit. Some of that could have been due to the team in 2015 did both vulnerability assessment and penetration testing. So as a result of that, they dug a little bit deeper into the network. And that could have caused some additional findings from our side that might have raised the bar associated with that year. So, but overall, if you look at the overall trend, the trend is going down. The number of vulnerabilities are being decreased within the network. They're on the right course there. And again, we shared as well the number of resolved and the number of new associated with those. The numbers internally look pretty good from our perspective. Associated with the network assessment and the high-level findings, we found 9 kind of classes of findings that we could lump together associated with things that were at more than one university. We represented those within the report at an elevated value, and these are the 9 findings. So missing a software patching and required updates. So basically a system like an Apache system. Maybe someone hasn't applied the right sets of updates associated with it. As a result, it now has a vulnerability that would allow someone to gain access to that system. Those are the kind of things that need to be applied on a regular basis. And as they do scanning, both the university system themselves, as well as when our team comes out and identifies those, they have to proactively look for and set those up. The second finding was unsupported operating systems, and what we're looking for there is things like Windows XP and Windows Server 2003, ones that have gone end of life and are no longer supported by the manufacturer. So you can't get a patch. Even if a known security issue comes up, they don't issue patches associated with it. Finding 3, easily guessed or default credentials. These have to do with, like when you go to Best Buy and you buy your printer, it comes with some default password on that printer. right? Or you get a Wi-Fi component and you're going to plug it in. It's plug and play. It might have a default password on there. That should be changed to something else once it's installed within the network. In some cases, they're either not changed or the just default components are left. And because of that, they're easily guessed. People can look them up and try at least those initial sets of passwords and see if they work
Klein.
Or not.
We have a question. Yeah. Senator Pepcorn.
Quick question. Yeah. I mean, why isn't that just an automatic for your tech people at the colleges and universities that they're not going to leave that default credential or easily guessed password on that right. on that piece of equipment they got? It should just automatically be. Why is that even on the list?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the reason that it's on the list is because we found it. So I'm trying to report a set of findings that we actually did find.
We'll ask as the university
to,
system.
As to why, yeah, and the university system will address this. Okay.
Thanks.
In terms of the rest of the findings, the next one, clear text passwords, there are some technologies like Telnet and HTTP that still use clear text. So if you use those for connections, anyone that can intercept that set of data going across is basically going to see clear text. If passwords are included inside of that, then password data is available in the clear. SSL certificate issues is actually a new finding this year. We hadn't run across this too much in the past, and we elevated it up. And it's because a lot of the web pages are switching from HTTP to HTTP secure. Almost all of them now are secure. Very, very few are still carried over HTTP. You're finding attackers going after the certificate side on a much more regular basis. So they find mechanisms to force the encryption to either downgrade to, and in some cases they can downgrade it to where no encryption is required, or they'll push it to a low enough level where they can actually crack it fairly easily. So the SSL.
Mr. Chairman. On that issue, what the intention of a hacker, what's it, to hold it hostage then or something?
It's actually to compromise the system. So if they can bypass the SSL certificate itself, let's say I'm making a request to you and you're the server, and I make a request and you say, okay, I want a handshake with you, but I want 256-bit encryption. And I say, no, I can't support that. Let's go down to a lower level of encryption. Can you go down? And you say, sure, I can go down. How about 128? And I said, no, that's not good. How about 64? 64, how about no encryption? Oh, yeah, I still like that. And so we go ahead and move forward. And now I've gotten you to a point where you have no encryption and you still accept it. So it's vulnerabilities on the system that caused this to happen. But because a lot of, you know, the systems have escalated in terms of all using encryption now, hackers are going after that encryption and trying to find ways to manipulate the encryption. So that's raised as an issue. That's new this year. Unsupported web servers, we found a few. Cross-site scripting and SQL injection are included as well. And they're more on the website and things that we find often. It's just one of those that they have to be dealt with as the university system has time. So that's the high level on the vulnerability assessment side. We provided recommendations to the university system. The university system has provided their response associated with their recommendations. If you look at them, we're pretty closely in alignment in terms of where they're going and what our recommendations are. On the phishing assessment, so just to make sure we're on the same page, so phishing, we're not talking phishing with a pole, we're actually talking sending some kind of an email or bait associated with something that the person might be interested in to try to get them to click on a link, so like a HTTP or HTTP secure link. And usually within that link, we're going to embed a page that looks like the page that the person would normally go to. So if they used Microsoft 365, let's say, for access. We'd give them a page that looks like Microsoft 365. We'd clone that page and present it to them. But in reality, it's not the page that they thought they were going to. And the differential might be instead of, you know, ndsu.the normal web page, it might be, say, ndus, you know, one or something else. Very similar, but a little bit different. But if the person doesn't look at it closely, they would assume that it's the same page. So in the phishing attempts, we looked at two different things. One, were the people that we were assessing, did they click the actual link? And then if they did click the link, we asked them to submit credentials. So things like a username and password or some validation that they actually went to the link and provided us credentialing data. We tested about 9,000, a little bit over 9,000 members of the North Dakota University System and campus faculty. About 3.4% of those clicked on the link. That number is very low. Typically, in phishing assessments that we do, 15 to 30% is a typical number. So kudos to the university staff. They were either very good at spreading the word or raising the bar in terms of their ability to detect and look at these type of emails. The second part of that is those that did click the link, did they submit credentials? And about 40% of those continued and submitted credentials. The industry averages in that regard are typically about 30 to 50%. So they fall pretty close to midline of what we would expect associated with someone submitting data there. And I've provided some industry data inside of the report from the Verizon data breach and a few others so that you have some historical data to look at if you're interested.
Mr. Chairman.
So, go ahead.
I didn't mean
Representative
Kevin. Like on that, but that's kind of, you know, like on those numbers up top there on the 3 and then the 40%,
mm-hmm.
the what's value, you know, I mean, because is it a value of this employee that's up in this type of, you know, or is it, where's the value at on their ability to access? Or is it just, you know, because I know we had that here a couple, 3-4 years ago. I remember there was three university employees that lost some money out of this type of deal. And but what's the value, you know, is it more their personal information just on that, or would it be a value to the system if they gained access further in, you know, on it, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, because in this case, let's say you're looking at 120 different sets of credentials, potentially, even if one of them maybe doesn't give you access that you want, it might get you one step closer to the access that you do want, or another one's going to work. So, you know, you only need one set of creds to get inside the system. And then it's a question of, you know, going back to the first slide I showed on methodology, it's then a scanning routine and a pivoting routine, right? And can I get to this other box? And then it's a scanning routine and a pivoting routine. So once you can get in the system, it makes it easier for you to then start the rest of the
and get scan. Something of value eventually.
Correct.
If you keep on it.
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
In terms of recommendations, we recommend that they continue phishing quarterly would be our recommendation. Verify spam filters, and we did some of that as we went through this exercise. And then a couple considerations. Look at potentially two-factor authentication, so the person would need the username, password, and a factor that's sent back to them in order to log in, like a PIN sent to your mobile device or something along that path. And then there's also mechanisms to do in-browser components as well, where they look at the data associated with that far end link that you're going to and whether or not it has perceived good behavior. And if it has perceived bad behavior or if it's, you know, on a block list somewhere, then the user's not going to be allowed to connect to that far end. It's going to keep them from some level of harm. All right, the last component, we reviewed a policy and procedure assessment and provided some findings. as part of this, we reviewed information security documentation provided by the North Dakota University System that was currently available, and they provided some guidance on documentation that they were building into the future. So there are about five or six additional policies that weren't available at the time that we performed the review, but we considered would be available in terms of just understanding that that was a path that they were going down and would be looking at building out. With the policies that they had available, we mapped those to the NIST cybersecurity framework. And the reason that we chose that, the cybersecurity framework pulls in COBIT 5, ISO 27001, and the NIST 853 series. So government and two commercial standards, and it brings it together into a framework that merges kind of all of those pieces. Because the university system doesn't really fall under 100% government, like structured government, like, you know, the military and things like that that use 851. And they also don't fall on the solely commercial side, like an ISO, you know, 27001. We felt like this would be a good framework to evaluate them against. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. And it provides some flexible guidance in terms of them moving forward with an ISMS, which is an information security management system. So how would they do this in terms of putting a framework around it? So we evaluated their policies against those framework controls, and we put them into categories. They either fully achieve the control, they largely achieve the control, partially achieve, or didn't achieve the control at all. Within the NIST cybersecurity framework, there's about 100 controls that basically have to be met associated with the framework as a whole. The framework doesn't require that you meet all of those. You identify based on your needs whether or not it's something that you need to build into your standard. But I would say for what the university system does, it makes sense that they should have all the controls in place over time. So we used this assessment to try to give them an idea of where they're at today, and then we made some recommendations associated with what they should do moving forward. One was to create a policies and procedures repository. They do have some of that in place today, but we want to make sure that all of the campuses have access to it and that they're able to get the right components involved associated with that. Evaluate the need for and create additional policies. So they have about five or six that were planned. We recommended additional policies on top of that five or six, just to build out the rest of the framework. Expand on the documents that they provided to us. So the policy documents they provided, some were very good, but we would recommend some additional build out of that set of policy documents. And then the university system itself would benefit from a thorough review and further customization of their policy requirements, as well as some structure associated with the NIST cybersecurity framework. So someone basically coming in and helping them understand that instead of putting this policy in place and then this policy in place and this policy, look at a more overarching framework of my intent is to protect this. This is my, you know, jewel that I want to protect. All right, how do I then build the rest around protecting that one piece? So do it more as a framework as opposed to putting specifically just policies in place. That's the end of my briefing. Here's my contact info if there are any questions.
Okay, any questions for Eric? All right, that was Senator Representative Clemente.
Mr. Chairman, Eric, did I understand you say this is the third year you've done this? Or?
Correct. It's the third year that we've done vulnerability assessments. So we've conducted those 3 years in a row. The phishing exercises we also conducted yearly. The policy and procedure review, this is the first year that we've done that.
Okay, and that's kind of what I was getting at, thinking about if this is the third year. It seemed like that was pretty basic. That was a pretty basic type of thing, that the policy and procedure review, because it sounds like most of this stuff is not attributable to the equipment or the software, although some might be, but mostly it's human error or lack of training or something like that. And
it depends, but yes, I get your point, and I think it depends on what the finding is.
Mr. Chairman, there's one.
Representative Kepenick.
Representative Clemene kind of hit it. Does it pay to do it that repetitious? You know, are you going to, you know, every year, does it pay, you know, or would it be better to wait, you know, have more of an interval type deal instead of an annual type situation? You know,
right.
Just because I know we've had conversations about something like this in the past. You know, we're doing this with, you know, government in general and
right.
stuff on it, and what the value is of every year versus, you know, like every 2 years or some tapes where you get a break in it.
Right. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it would be my recommendation, based on the ability of the university system at this stage, to take over the vulnerability assessment. So every year, including the first year that we came in, well, maybe the first year, some of the campuses probably didn't have scanning capability, but over the 3 years that we've done this, all of the campuses at this stage have their own scanning capability. And typically, as we're performing the scans, the yearly scan that we do, they're validating those scans on their side as well. So they have the ability at this point to do the scanning and to then act on that scanning data appropriately. And as you can see from the trending, the action right now is in a positive path. So I think the right approach would be come back in a few years and just validate that it's continuing on that path. A more beneficial place to potentially put funding would be on the policy and procedure side. So get some support for where they're going associated with policies and procedures and move that forward more rapidly to get them into a much tighter lockstep with the NIST cybersecurity framework than where they're at right now.
Okay, we're going to take one more question before we go to the university
Thank
system.
You,
Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to address Representative Kepenick's question about taking the time off. Remember in the audit budget, the security audits? Mm-hmm. Took those out for the next biennium, and then we'll revisit it when we come back after that. So it's kind of exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. Eric, thank you so much. Appreciate that. We're going to have someone from the university system make some comments.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darren King. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the university system. First off, I'd like to thank the State Auditor's Office and Eric and his team. We find this to be a very valuable experience over the last few years that they've helped us through this process. I'll maybe just touch on the three areas. Our responses are in the document, so I won't go through those detailed, but certainly would take questions on any of those. But from the standpoint of vulnerability scanning, I think Eric is right on target. I think we're showing improvement. We feel like we have a ways to go. My feeling on vulnerability scanning, it's much more about your ability to respond, because vulnerabilities come and go on such a regular basis that it's about us building our capacity to deal with vulnerabilities as they show up. And he was right, we do have much better scanning capabilities than we did 3 years ago in that area, which I think accounts for our continued improvement in those areas. If you look at the phishing assessment, that's an area that in the first go-around, we were very much like the rest of the world. I think our numbers were too high. We did make a fairly concerted effort, not only at the system, but at the campus level, to do a better job with education and communication with people so that they were better at seeing when phishing came through. At the same time, I think we've done a better job of controlling those also. So hopefully not as many of them are getting to end users. And the policy and procedure, I think, again, I would completely concur with Eric's assessment of that. I think we've made progress on those. We certainly didn't have, we had about a 15-year-old policy framework in place 3 years ago when I came to the university system. And we've made steady progress towards trying to update our security policies and procedures and standards. That said, I certainly think that's an area we need to continue to focus on and grow that out. As Eric said, to try to hit all of those NIST recommended security controls. So with that, I would take any questions anybody might have.
Any questions for Darren? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. King, in the context of security, what is the university system's policy around bringing your own device, especially about staff, but also students?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Rose Hansen, you know, it's a pretty open environment. People, especially when you think of our students, you know, students are bringing in devices every day, which certainly makes some of these things not only difficult but also important for us to understand. So it certainly is different than a business, you know, where you can really lock down and restrict outside devices from coming onto your network.
Mr. Chairman, just one short one. How many do you provide state or university system students' email addresses for everybody, or is it? I was just curious because I know some that are going like NDSU and they have, you know, they use those quite a bit, and I don't know how much personal use they use them on, but I know they use them quite a bit for email and stuff, and that's why I was just wondering.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Kepinich, yes, we do. We provide NDUS provided email addresses for all of our faculty, staff, and students. You know, in that context, they still have vanity domains, so it looks like it's coming from somebody at Valley City State or NDSU, but it's a system that we had 11 different tenants just over 2 years ago, and we've been working very hard to consolidate into a single system, and we're down to the last two campuses to do that. We'll have those done by summer. So.
Okay, committee, any last questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to look for a motion to accept these last two reports, and we're going to make one motion, by the way, to accept them both.
I move that we accept the reports on the space utilization study and the vulnerability study that is presented.
Motion from Senator Lee, a second from Representative Nelson over there. His hand went up. All right, any other discussion on that motion? Any other discussion? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll on the motion to accept these two audits.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Klein?
Aye.
Lee?
Aye.
Pepcorn?
Aye.
Representatives Pollard?
Aye.
Hattelstead?
Yeah.
Excuse me, Hansen? Kepinich?
Yeah.
Clemine?
Yes.
Kreit?
Yeah.
Marigos? Martinson? Mock? Nathie?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion passed.
Okay, committee, anything else? Michael, you have anything else? Representative Clemine.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so we accepted these reports, but it seemed like there were some things indicated in the reports that weren't done or need to be done. So where does that go from here? Is this the end of it or what?
Well, the reports are here. Does it mean it's the end of it? I think all of us understand it shouldn't be. I think I'm hoping the university system has listened to our concerns. Other than if I'm not sure. Alan?
Mr. Chairman, generally with the performance audits, the auditor's office will do a follow-up later on and come back with their process to implement the recommendations.
So, Representative Clemine, are you okay? Any other comments, anything else to come before the committee? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a motion about an audit and some information I'd like to give to support that motion, if we'd have time to do that now.
Do we have time to do that? You want to do that?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, my motion would be to audit the oil and gas division system for gathering, recording, and reporting oil and gas production. And I'll drop a copy of that off.
Thank you, Mike.
might be easier if I just stand up here. So
it might be easier. Okay, Representative Nelson.
Okay.
Purpose.
The purpose of this is, I'll look here. Basically, I took information from the director's cut, which if you go on the oil and gas division, that's in their information center. And they give the oil production every month. You read it in the newspapers, if nothing else, but they give a lot of other things of that. And then there's a subscription service for statewide production data. And that, the first page of that, like if you were actually in, that's what this particular looks like a spreadsheet is. And that comes off their website, but it's a subscription service. So many of you probably have never seen it. There's about, I don't know, it's 20,000 some records on that. And every well has a record. And if you go across, it's a file, API is American Petroleum Institute. Every oil well has a unique number, where the production's from, and then barrels of oil and barrels of gas or cubic feet of gas and so on as it goes. And if you get then to your spreadsheet that I handed out, every month, a couple months later, there's a preliminary report of our production, and then there's a final report. And if you go to the well file and add them all up, of course those numbers differ from what the reports are. And if you look at the difference in the final well, that would be the fifth column over. The differences start out fairly large. So like November of 2016, right now we have just gotten our final number. And you can see the difference right now as of the 3rd of March is 1,655,000 barrels. And then if you go over a course of a year, the numbers get closer. But they never merge. There's always 200, 250,000 barrels of oil every month that do not get charged back or credited back to an oil well. And so the thing is that this is the file that royalty owners and such use to tell that they're being treated fairly. So we want those numbers to be as close as possible. And it's just a huge, you know, what happens is any time for the first year, the reported number on a well can change. And if you get down to those couple of lines that are kind of separately, March 2016, January 2015, what I'm showing on there is you'll see in the fourth and fifth columns, like for March, the 1st of June 2016, and then the 3rd of March 2017. You'll see that those two numbers differ by about 1 million barrels. Well, what happens is that well file changes, and there's no trail. It doesn't tell you that the number changed or anything like that. But between those two dates for the production on March 6, 2016, the number of barrels that were charged back, shall we say, to a particular well changed by 1 million barrels. And so the difference is based on the date change. And if you go down to the January, you'll see a similar thing that as of May 25th, there was a 1,000,007 barrels different. But when we get all the way to March 3rd of this year, about a quarter of a million barrels. And the thing is this is really a big mess. It's a big data problem. And we're in a period of fair stability. And so we've got all these companies reporting. We've got the oil and gas working with it. We've got reports coming out. And this all affects an awful lot of people. And so I'm not saying that anything's being done wrong here, but I'm saying this would be a good time now for auditors to come in and look at the procedures of the oil and gas division and look at how the numbers are being generated and worked with and everything like that to see if maybe improvements in accuracy or maybe improvements in workflow or something like that could be done, that I think this is just a good time to look at that. And it might be possible the auditor might look at this and come back in a month or so and say something about scope or something, and I can understand that. But I'm just asking for a relatively narrow audit, just really on these numbers, how they're being generated, how they're changing, and how they're being reported to the public,
because the public uses these. I mean, this is, like I say, this is the public's check. This is what North Dakota is telling an oil well owner that this number should be. And when we look at this discrepancy, we want that as small as possible, because people, including the state of North Dakota, aren't getting their royalty on those barrels, basically. And so we want everything here to be as accurate and as efficient as possible. So.
All right, Senator Judy Lee.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, before I would be likely to support the audit request, I would certainly like to hear from oil and gas to find out if they can tell us how they assemble these. There could be an answer. It's much easier than having a whole audit, and maybe not.
Okay. Representative Kepner.
Mr. Chairman, in a different life, I actually did collect oil out of tanks, out of tank batteries. There's more people looking at where this goes than anybody. I mean, they proof wells once a month. You know, I don't think what we need, if there's issues, it'd be at the level, this report here, then it would be at who's getting what and the accuracy that way. We had this when I first got up here. We had the PSC and the oil and gas out there checking wells. This has been an ongoing thing for ever since we've had oil production, of if it's accurate or not. There's more people looking over somebody's shoulder to see if every well, every barrel's counted for, than probably, because that's everybody's paycheck. That ain't just the royalty holder's paycheck. That's the operator's paycheck. That's the person hauling the oil's paycheck. It's the shipper's paycheck. I mean, there's more paychecks hinged on what a well's producing, you know. And we're going to have the budget. I mean, it's one thing if this was in the interim, it might be a little more interesting, but we're going to have their budget in front of us. I'd just soon have more information before we get a full-blown performance audit on, even if it is in narrow scope, because it's what the information we're going to have, what are we going to do with it anyways in the process, because we're not going to be in session. You know, it's more for if there is something. I'd just soon ask them the direct question right now and have that instead of doing an audit on them.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. You know, I thought about asking oil and gas in here, but since I've been on the committee, that's never been our practice. You know, we didn't have the development foundations in here to answer questions when we voted on whether to have a development foundation, or we didn't have NDSU come in when we voted on those and stuff. So, I mean, that's really just not been our practice. And a lot of this is jumping to the conclusion of what we're maybe going to find. I don't know what we're going to find. There's a lot of numbers here. It's complicated. And maybe there's an improvement someplace. To sit here, you know, and even ask oil and gas, there's always explanations for why there's numbers, but that's the same with every other agency that we audit. And so I'm just looking, like I say, at this period of time, this is a little bit of a slowdown, and this is a time when we could look at this again. It's a complicated thing. There's many more thousand wells being operated than there was before. Maybe we could gain just something in efficiency as far as how these numbers are being generated. So.
Okay. I believe we have a second. Did you second, Representative? Okay. Because we need a second. All right. We've had the discussion. Representative Clemene.
Well, just to continue the discussion, I guess I'm not prepared to vote yes on this motion without the kind of information that Senator Lee and Representative Kempinick referred to. I'd like to hear, even maybe you haven't done this before, but it seems like...
Well, this certainly, I was unaware of the discussion that this was going to come up. So committee members, I'm as surprised as everyone. That's what we do here, but... I think
Mr.
without
Chairman,
further discussion.
If the committee wants to bring oil and gas in and ask question that this would continue on to the next time, I'd actually be fine with that. I have no problem with that. That's just not been our practice. So,
Representative Pollard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Government Ops has the Industrial Commission now in the second period, or do you have them in the first period?
No, they're coming. They're coming.
You have them now.
We have them now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then I would say real quick, why wouldn't we want those folks to get the questions answered so we decide whether before the next meeting of LAFRC of what we want to do.
So, Representative Nelson, would you like to retract your motion, or you want us to vote?
Well, I'd be willing to retract if you want to talk with oil, gas about stuff and everything. That'd be fine. We can work with it next time, because I mean that's just.
The will of the committee, is that okay if Representative?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pollard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kempinick, I know, is in that section. I know Representative Nafee is in that section. I guess they would, they hear what we're talking about to try and find out if there is, so they could come back to us and then decide if this is warranted for a motion from Representative Nelson again or not. I guess that's how I would look at it, to get some information.
Well, like I said, this is
Representative Kevin.
This has been an ongoing issue for, this isn't a unique conversation. I'd like to, you know, if there is, I was just on because I had subscribed. I got a bookmark so I can, and there is different numbers. There's no doubt about it. But I don't know if, you know, at the end of the day, they should match up between what the companies are on a well or and what's getting paid. I'd be surprised that there's that much difference. But if it is, it might be, there's something going on a lot farther down the line than what's being reported at the oil and gas division of or NDIC. So it's the only issue that I
can. All right. I will the second will go away also. All right. We'll have that conversation at the next meeting then. After we learn more. So anything else? Anything else to come before the committee? Hearing none. There's a motion to adjourn. Is there a second? All in favor of the motion say aye. Opposed, no. Motion carried.
We don't do it on anybody else.